Accession number 9434, reel 13.
Mr. Bill Collins, reel 13. We were talking about how Usol largely replaced iodine at this time, and you were explaining why and the effects iodine had on nerve endings, I think. If you could explain it.
Yeah, well, iodine burns the nerve endings. That's why when you apply iodine to a cut on your hand, you get a burning sensation for a very short time. Afterwards, it goes very quickly, but it's like putting almost a hot iron to them. And it induces a certain amount of shock, you see. You couldn't possibly apply it to a large area, open wound area. Anyway, Usol had no such bad characteristics. It was much more bland, you know. You could apply Usol and get no burning sensation, and just as powerful an antiseptic action. So that was what we were using afterwards.
So you'd carry bottles of this instead of...
Usol, yeah.
Would you still take some iodine with you?
Oh, yes. Well, oh, yes, for small cuts and small wounds, I still think it's the best. I use it myself to this day. If I have a small cut, I've always got a bottle of iodine, which I apply straight away.
So, but the Usol was a breakthrough. Were there any other breakthroughs or new developments that you can put your finger on?
Not that I can put my finger on, no. Of course, I haven't said a word about gas, the new developments in gas.
Would you like to cover that?
Yes, because we're getting gas shells, you see. We were soon to get gas shells, and they were getting them on the Somme. You see, there was Blue Cross or arsenic, a Yellow Cross mustard gas, and there was another gas shell, and very very nasty too. The Yellow Cross, the mustard gas, as it was called, was particularly nasty. All that happened was the shell used to burst with a plop. That's all. All you heard was a plop, and the shell burst open, and the liquid came out. And when it met the air, it gasified. It was gaseous. The moment it met the air, it became gaseous, and because it soaked the ground in where the shell had fallen. And if some unfortunate soldier happened to sit in that shell, only made a very small shell hole, if he happened to sit in it, he'd have everything burnt away. It would burn everything away very quickly. It was a brilliant... And the gas, mustard gas, attacked it, all the, what we call the vesicular parts of the body. The underarm, between the elbow, by the ear, everywhere, all where the lymphatic glands are. That's what it attacked. And it was a very, very nasty gas. Very bad invention, that.
Were you trained in any methods of how to treat any of these gases?
None. That was left to the hospitals.
So what would you do if you had a mustard gas casualty come through? What would you do to him? Would you just send him on his way, or would you...
Well, if he was burned particularly bad, you could put some gauze, put a bit of gauze over it, you see. Gauze and a bit of wool on top. Just to keep the air away from it, and bandage him, and send him down quickly. It was getting him down to hospital for treatment, which was the job to do.
Had you been issued with better gas masks by this time? I presume you had.
Yes, by 1915, we'd been issued with the PH helmet, which was the Ku Klux Klan blanket helmet, you know, flannel helmet, with a nozzle which made a rude noise poking out, you see. By the time the Somme came round, we'd been issued with the box respirator, which fitted over the front of the body, and you had a headpiece and breathed through it, which was much more efficient. So there were only two types of respirator issued during the war. The Ku Klux Klan one, as I say, the flannel, the mask, and the box respirator.
Now, one thing that I wanted to ask about, that we mentioned gangrene and the danger from the cold getting into
yes.
it. I believe there's also something called gas gangrene, which was caused by infections in the soil.
Yes.
Did you know anything about that?
No, I never encountered a gas gangrene one, but I heard about them. You know, it's an infection. It would be a condition created by this mustard gas shell. That would be the one. It wouldn't be any other type. See, the phosgene, which was the phosgene gas, which attacked the lungs, and the blue cross, which was the most dangerous of all, the arsenical gas, which attacked the brain, that was very bad.
Did you ever see any?
I never saw any. I saw some phosgene casualties, and they were very nasty. They attacked the lungs, you see. But the mustard gas was the one which the Germans used most, because you see, they could saturate. They used to use it in saturation. They'd fire literally hundreds and sometimes thousands of shells full with mustard gas to make a place impossible to hold. You see, if they were going to attack, they would attack it first of all with mustard gas.
Right, now, so you were up in the line. In the Arras sector. How long did you stay there? Came back from Phampu.
We were only there about a fortnight to 3 weeks in the Arras sector. And we went back to, this is 1917, we went back to get ready for the opening of the big attack on the Ypres front. See? The big that started on the 31st of July, so we didn't have a long time. We were always getting ready, you know, always prepared. The mounted pack section was alerted, and I went up with my mounted crowd for that one. But as you know, or probably have read, on the 30th of July, the 30th of July. It was lovely and fine, warm, sun. But on the 31st, the first day of the attack, it was not too bad. But on the first of August, it started to rain, and it never stopped. We were the whole of the 1st Cavalry Division were in what do we call those poles, the things again? Shelters, you know, canvas shelters. They were in a field, and they were under canvas shelters. We were under canvas shelters. Some bell tents. Officers had some bell tents, but the rain was merciless. It came down, and we were on the other side. We were close to the canal bank, not far from the canal bank, at Ypres, and in flat ground. I think between Poperinghe and the canal bank. And the rain, it came down, it was merciless. Everybody was soaked, wet, and we had 3 weeks of it. But
Again,
the attack never made sufficient progress to give us any chance of getting in action to action, you see. And, of course, back went the cavalry again.
So, once again, you went back to your base?
Went back to our base, yes. We went back to our base,
So you'd not been in action at all?
Not since Arras, you see. Not been in action. We didn't get into action at all at 1st Ypres. We went back until later in the year. I remember at the beginning of 1917, the Germans decided to retreat from an impossible position they had on the Somme, right back to what was known as the Hindenburg Line, you see, and which was close to St. Quentin. And they decided to retreat. And, of course, they were followed up all the way through that retreat. And we landed up forward, but there's no doubt that the idea was to make some sort of attack there later in the year, but I personally was sent on a course. I went on a course, gas course, in 1917. And then I went...
When abouts in 17 was this?
This would be
in August, September. After the start of Third East.
And then after that, I was sent up to Ypres, to the northern end of Ypres. While the field ambulance was down at St. Quentin, I suppose waiting for the big tank attack there, I was sent up to the northern end to run a stretcher party of some 18 stretcher bearers, and I was sent up there. We were quartered on the canal bank at Boosing, a place called Boosing, and every day there was a very large cavalry working party there, a working and reserve party. You see, the attack from Passchendaele was still going on in October, beginning of October. The attack was at its height, you see, for Passchendaele. But this very large cavalry working party, composed of men from every cavalry unit you can think of, every regiment you can think of, were keeping the road open from Boosing right up to Polkapel, which was the front line. They were keeping the track open by pitching in stones, bricks, anything they could think of, you see, from the villages which had been flattened to the ground between, like places like Langemark, you see. And there we were, my stretcher bearers were in a tarpaulin cover. That was what I was trying to think of just now, with the poles, and they were under this tarpaulin on the bank, and I had to build a tent with my batman. And every night at midnight, regularly on the stroke of 12, we would lay down, we'd hear the sound boom, rush. The Germans would put over 6 shells regularly every night right into our camp. Right into the camp. And one night they put over a shell which went into the ground at the edge of where this tarpaulin was and my stretcher bearers. Right at the edge of the thing. If it had gone another yard in, it would have cut 2 or 3 of them to pieces. But it went in the edge, it went down 30 feet into the ground and exploded, blew them all up into the air. And then in the next 10 minutes, there was a lake there, mud and water. And I heard it. Well, I got up and got around, and we got a party of cavalrymen to help pull them out of the mud. They were struggling in the mud, you see. We got them all out, and an officer came along, a staff officer with his shaded torch, and he said to me, "Well, where's the RAMC?" I said, "I'm sorry, sir." I said, "They're all in the mud. They're the only ones affected." And he looked at me as if as much as saying, "Are you pulling my leg?" I said, "They're the only ones affected." I said, "Look at them all." I said, "That's my stretcher party." And the shell went down on the edge of the tarpaulin and it's blowing them all up. And they're all in the mud. Oh, he says, "Oh." But so that was a very lucky escape for them. And to their credit, that was about midnight. To their credit, at 3 next morning, they all turned up and went up the line with me to between Langemark and Kolkapel and stood by for casualties. Because we had to stand by the road party, could be shelled any minute, and they was shelled. We had to stand by and get the casualties on the right on the where they were hit.
So that was your function, was to collect casualties from...
From that working party. See, they were working right close to keep the track open for transport. And we used to go up every morning up this duckboard track from below Boosing right up to Langemark. And, you know, we were stepping over a couple of dead men every morning. They were laid across the track because they couldn't be moved into the side. They'd just been sucked into the mud. They were collected by the Pioneer Party and buried. But we stepped over them every morning. We never failed to step over a man and one or two dead men. And that it was a nightmare, because all you had was a couple of duck boards side by side, and either side of it was about 10 feet of mud, 12 feet, with the top of a tank sticking out of it here and there. And we got onto the road. The track stopped at Langemark. And there at Langemark, the place, of course, had been flattened to the ground, and there was a board at the side of the road propped up, and on it was stenciled, "This was Langemark." Now, I saw another one on the Somme called "This was Villers Carbonell," but that was the only evidence there was that a town ever stood there. Only that board, though, all the bricks and the rubble were laying on the ground. Of course, that was what our working party were using to fill in the track with. You see, they were filling it and stamping it down with rammers. Now, what the thing that happened there?
Hang on, before we go on, you were talking about the duckboard and the mud on either side, 10 foot of mud. Would it be physically dangerous then if you fell off this duckboard?
Well, if you fell off it, it would take a traction engine to pull you out almost. It was that deep. It was absolutely sucking mud. That's why they laid the dead across the stretchers, across the duckboards. If they'd put them on the side of the off the duckboards, they'd have been sucked into the mud.
When you say it was sucking mud, in what way? Was it just very glutinous, or was it very thin?
Well, glutinous. Oh, it was glutinous. There's a memorial on the Menin Gate to 60,000 men whose bodies were never recovered in that small Ypres salient. They were all sucked into the mud.
If you fell in, you wouldn't then be able to get out unaided?
No, not unaided. There were cases where one or two men slipped off the duckboards, and it took a couple of their comrades to pull them out gradually, inch by inch. They managed to keep their arms out, and they'd pull them out inch by inch out of the mud and got them on again, on the boards again.
Didn't this make carrying stretchers, especially full stretchers, along this board very difficult and dangerous?
It would be something terribly difficult. But the point is, my stretcher bearers, and I had carried what casualties we had. We carried them straight down the road to Boosing, straight down the road. You see, the duckboard tracks were used to keep the roads clear for transport. So I used to use the road for casualties.
That was legitimate transport.
Yeah, legitimate, yes. You see, there was one last incident there that's worth recording. The first day I went there, there was a bit of shelling, and I looked around for a place. Where can I put a casualty on a stretcher? You know, if we had perhaps say 8 or 9 casualties or 10 casualties, you'd have to lay some down while you were getting the wounded. So I looked around for a place, and I saw on about 50 yards off the road a pillbox. You know, these are the big concrete business things the Germans built for defence. And I thought to myself, I'll go and have a look and see what it's like, see if it's possible to use it as a shelter for wounded. And I went gingerly over the ground. It was very sodden. And I got to this pillbox, and I looked in, and there was a German, dead German, supposedly dead German, I think he must have been dead, laying flat across the bottom of that pillbox with his arms and legs splayed out in an almost theatrical fashion, you see. And I looked at him, because he was dead all right. I looked at his eyes, and they were all glazed over, and that, there was no smell. He didn't smell like the German dead usually do. And I looked at him, and I was going to bend over and touch him. Then all the bells, the alarm bells, rang in my brain and told me not to touch him at all, because when I got away, I thought to myself, 10 to 1, he's booby-trapped. Because they were booby-trapping at the time, the Germans were doing a lot of booby-trapping. And I thought to myself, 10 to 1, that otherwise someone else would have removed him before now. So that washed out the idea of my using the pillbox as a shelter for wounded.
Would you have left a note on the door or anything, warning others? Or
No. There was no note when I got there, and I left it because I thought to myself, it must be well known that this fellow's maybe is booby-trapped, you see. And it was an isolated bit of isolated ground. There was nothing around it, no trenches around it. It was just on there. It was with a wonderful field of fire, looking over where our people attack from. But I noticed one. You see, the Germans are clever as cats. The back end, the back of the pillbox facing the German line, was paper thin. All the rest of the box is 2 feet thick, but the back end, the entrance, was paper thin. So if we attempted to use it, they could put a shell right into the box if they were accurate enough.
Now, you made one interesting comment. You said it didn't smell like German dead usually smell.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, the German has a peculiar smell. You know, when a man's being laying dead for a bit, usually an odour, you know, a bit of an odour. After a time, that goes. A man who's been dead for a long time doesn't smell at all. I mean, in the Vermels trenches, one day, we dug up some casualties of the previous October fighting, September fighting, October fighting, and they were bone dry and with no smell at all.
But you say the Germans had a specific smell?
Oh, they had a peculiar smell, the German. If you stood and sniffed the back of the neck of a German, it's got a peculiar odour. Quite a peculiar odour.
Can you describe it in
any
way?
It's a musty sort of odour. Musty. That's the best word I can use. Musty.
Right. Now, you were in this area, going up and down the duckboard track and back down the road with the casualties.
Yeah.
Can you describe to us the general landscape that you could see? Was it as devastated as photographs would have appear?
Absolutely bad. You couldn't see a building or a tree, anything at all. As far as the eye could see, there was nothing. It was completely down. You see, we were at the almost at the extreme northern end of the Ypres salient. Looking down southwards, you were looking down right across the base of the salient, and halfway up the salient, we were looking right across villages and everything which had been completely devastated in the 4 months fighting. 4 months fighting, and there was not a tree, not a bush, nothing at all.
What about shell holes? Were they Were there a lot?
Oh, touching one another.
So the this mud we discussed earlier, it was of such a, there was so much of it you couldn't get across it. It was general, that amount of mud.
Yeah, either side of you, it was a bog. You see, it was a bog, and all water and mud. The duckboard track had been laid early on, and they compressed it hard, and they'd obviously put some bottom to it, put some sand or concrete or something onto it to keep the duckboards from sinking into it. Otherwise, they'd have gone straight in.
How long were you at Borsing?
I was at Borsing until the beginning of November. And then one day, beginning of November, yes, one day, beginning would be the beginning of November, one day I got a note from a medical officer he gave me a note, he said, look, he said, Sergeant, I want you to take a man down to base, to Rouen. I want you to take him down, take his rifle, make sure, he says, you may not be able to sleep for 3 or 4 or 5 nights, but I want him watched day and night and handed over to this general hospital in Rouen. So I almost said, it's a funny assignment. Anyway, I took him down. I forget his regiment now. What was wrong with him, I don't know, but I had a sealed envelope with sealing wax and a seal on it, given to me, take him down. I took him down to Poperang station, railway station, got on a train, and we went down to Rouen, and I tell you, I was pretty tired by the time I got there. I had his rifle, and his ammunition, and took him down there, and I handed him over to this general hospital, and I don't know to this day what was wrong with him, what was the matter with him, what the idea was at all, but I handed him over and went back to a rest camp outside Rouen, awaiting transport, to go back to my field ambulance again, and which I'd been cut off for several weeks. And I got on got transport, and I landed back on the I never took bit, and it was never able to take part in the battle. The tank, the Victor,
Cambrai,
the one
at Cambrai, you mean?
The Cambrai battle. I was never able to. I was miles away when the Cambrai. I was down at Rouen when the Cambrai battle was being fought, and when I got back, the German counterattack had been made, and I got back there just in time when the counterattack had been held, and we were keeping stretcher bearer parties available to for any move, you know, any casualties that were occurring in the raid. One or two raids took place. Our people raided them once or twice to try and find out their strength, and we kept stretcher bearer parties going for that job. But I got back after that. All that business had been finished. All I saw of it was the tanks, which had taken part in the battle, loaded onto railway trucks and being taken away. Those that had, you know, survived the attack. And we are now into December 1917. December 1917. And we went back to, we didn't go back to Montreal. We went back to a place called Cappy, C-A-P-P-Y, on the Somme. That's near Bray on the Somme. And we took over a French series of huts and dugouts and spent the winter there.
Now, the war had been going on for some time. You were a regular.
Yeah.
You told me you had accepted the early territorials you met, the London Scottish and such like.
Oh, yeah.
How did you feel about the later territorial, not quite such elite, perhaps, territorial regiments that came out? And then how did you feel about the conscripts that started to come in? I don't know whether they came into your unit, but...
Well, the conscripts hadn't started to come in, and the conscription was not brought in until July 1917. And the time they got them into the army and trained them, most of them didn't get out there until 1918. You see, early 1918.
So you had no noise. What about the territorials you'd come across?
Oh, they were all right, were first class. Territorials were first class. No doubt about that. And of course, the volunteers, you know, the men who volunteered before the July conscription, they were all right, they were first class. No doubt about that. I once watched a battalion of London Regiment going into action, and they looked marvellous, absolutely wonderful. You know, first well trained, well disciplined, marching discipline was perfect, and they looked as fit as fiddles. Oh no, there was nothing wrong with the new army. It was called the New Army. There was nothing wrong with the New Army. Only men of tremendous guts and courage could sustain the casualties which they sustained in those infantry battles of 1916 and 1917. Only men of the top class courage.
So you didn't feel that regulars were particularly superior to these people?
Not by the regular army, because by then was almost extinct. The army that I went to France with in 1914 was practically wiped out by the time the Somme battle came round. There were very few left. Mainly the cavalry regiments.
Were you given a special status yourself as an old soldier by any new recruits that came your way?
No, not at all. No, we wore stripes on our unit, service stripes on our left sleeve. A red one denoted 1914, and the blue ones denoted the years that followed. One for each year of service.